Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Ringgit and Cents, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Roshan Kanesan. As the United States prints more US dollars to fund its own COVID-19 related economic recovery, Bitcoin has gained more prominence alongside gold as a hedge against the potential devaluation that the world's reserve currency could face. Now, Bitcoin is up around 70% over the last 3 months, now trading at about 40,000 ringgit per Bitcoin. Now, with that in mind, today we explore the basics of Bitcoin, where it gets its value from, and why it's so popular. To help me with this, I'm speaking with Aaron Tang, Malaysia Country Manager for Luno. Luno is a platform to buy, sell, and store digital assets like Bitcoin and is one of the three approved digital asset exchanges by the Securities Commission. Aaron, welcome to Ringgit and Cents.
Hi, Roshan. Thanks for having me.
Let's just start off with the basics here. Now, Bitcoin was the first, or at least the first prominent cryptocurrency, which is essentially a decentralized digital asset. Before we get into Bitcoin itself, could you explain and break down the concept of cryptocurrency?
Right. Think of Bitcoin as a form of digital money. When we think about the evolution of money and how money has changed over thousands of years, we can see that money has changed from things like barter to coins to paper and to something that we're very comfortable with today, which are e-wallets and digital money. So think of Bitcoin almost like the next step in how money and stores of value have changed over time. The word crypto in cryptocurrency actually refers to cryptography, which is basically clever maths techniques that are used to secure financial transactions. So in a nutshell, Bitcoin cryptocurrency is kind of a combination of all these factors, and you have this really interesting technology and also a form of a digital asset which people can use very easily.
Now, underlying all of this is blockchain technology. Could you explain to us what that is and why that became such a buzzword over the last few years?
Right. So blockchain is actually the technology that cryptocurrencies are based upon. Now, not many people know this, but the technology behind blockchain has actually existed since the 90s. So it's been around for a pretty long time. But it was only in 2008, 2009, when Bitcoin was introduced, that blockchain technology actually made its way into the mainstream. I would say that cryptocurrencies are actually the first, or rather a very good use case for blockchain technology, which has existed a long time. So looking into the technology itself, I think of blockchain as a really clever way for millions of people on the internet. These are people far away from each other. They don't know each other. Think of a really distributed group of people all over the world. So blockchain is a way that these people can use to collaborate and share data together. Now, this data can be any kind of data, mind you. It could be medical records, it could be university certificates. But so far, blockchain has proven to be very powerful in the space of financial transactions. So basically what people are sharing across the internet using this very clever technology called blockchain is financial transactions.
Isn't there a concern over privacy if this is distributed across all these different people across the world?
Yeah. So I think the really clever thing about blockchain is it allows you to get this really delicate balance between privacy and also security, which is where the word cryptography, or rather the technology of cryptography, is really so powerful. It allows, like in the case of Bitcoin, which is the number one cryptocurrency, it allows people to actually see transactions happening without actually revealing who are the exact people behind those transactions. So you can prove that the transactions are real, that they are legitimate, but you do not actually know who's behind the transactions if you do not go beyond the surface level.
Right, so you can see the flow, but you can't see from where to who.
Yeah, exactly. That's, of course, on the surface level. If we're talking about, say, a law enforcement level, that you know people are trying to track transactions for a specific purpose, this is, of course, possible. There are further tools that can go deeper into this.
All right, Aaron. So now that we're a little clearer on what cryptocurrency is and the role of blockchain, tell us about Bitcoin and its rise to fame. Why is it so popular?
Bitcoin is the most established cryptocurrency. It actually came about not too long ago. It was released first in 2009. Basically, it was worthless back then. It was just an experiment between a couple of tech geeks who thought that this is some really cool technology that, you know, we want to try together. Fast forward about, what's it now? 12 years now. Today, it's $180 billion US dollars asset class, with one Bitcoin being about 9,700 US dollars today, or as you pointed out just now, about 40,000 ringgit. So millions of people around the world use Bitcoin. And it's interesting because governments and institutions are actually getting into this digital currency space as well.
All right, Aaron. So now we mostly know where all these different currencies come from, right? The Malaysian ringgit comes from Malaysia. The US dollar is printed in the US. Where does Bitcoin come from?
Bitcoin is decentralized technology. So it's very interesting because nobody actually really knows who's the founder or who's the founding team behind Bitcoin. But what we do know, what we can see, is the source code for Bitcoin, which is basically the computer code that powers all the infrastructure behind Bitcoin. This is freely made available on the internet. It's what we call open source technology, meaning that anyone can look at it and make sure that there's not like any, there's no funny things going on behind the code, like stealing your money or doing fraud or anything. So it's really interesting because it's completely decentralized. There's no sort of founder or no founding team behind it.
So we're very used to having central banks and regulators keeping an eye on things. If this is decentralized, then how do you keep an eye on things? Isn't there an inherent risk in that?
You're right. I think, Roshan, we are very comfortable with this idea of centralization. It's in everything we do, right? For example, when we grow up, we go to a school, that this education system is centralized. So decentralized systems are kind of a bit uncomfortable sometimes, especially the first time you hear about them. But especially in the case of things like digital assets like Bitcoin, the concerns around, you know, who's watching the transactions, are they being used for illegal activity? Actually, governments have taken a role in trying to regulate this. For example, look at Malaysia. We have pretty good regulations around digital assets. So whenever a company like us, we are interested to be a digital asset exchange, we do have to apply to the Securities Commission. We do have to notify Bank Negara. So I think countries around the world and regulators, they are starting to warm up to this idea of digital assets. And granted, there is some level of, decentralization and privacy, but they have put in their regulations some of this risk mitigation around, risks around illegal activity.
All right, so regulation does have a role here. So when Luno comes into town, they have to go through the Securities Commission and you have to talk to Bank Negara as well. For the consumers out there, it is very important to take note that whatever platform you're using, please ensure that it's listed with the Securities Commission or Bank Negara. Aaron, is there anything I'm missing there?
No, I think you got it right, Roshan. Sometimes people ask this question, right? Especially those who are who are believers in decentralization. The question is, you know, it's a decentralized technology. Why is regulation important? Now, for us, we believe regulation is important because, first of all, not everyone is like a super well-informed, sophisticated investor. Maybe a sophisticated investor would be able to invest overseas and do it well. But I think for the general population, regulation needs to come in because it protects investors. If there's a problem with the platform, at least the investors know they can approach the SC, they can approach Bank Negara for some kind of remediation or to help them if they ever encounter any problems.
I've been speaking to Aaron Tang, Malaysia Country Manager for Luno. Up next, is Bitcoin the new gold? Stay tuned to Ringgit and Sense to find out.
Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Welcome back to Ringgit and Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Roshan Karnison. Today, I'm speaking to Aaron Tang, Malaysia Country Manager for Luno, one of the three approved digital asset exchanges in Malaysia by the Securities Commission. A little while ago, Aaron, we were talking about investors or sophisticated investors. And in May, famed investor and hedge fund manager Paul Tudor Jones said he bought into Bitcoin as a hedge against the inflation he sees coming from money printing, saying it reminded him of gold. This marks a significant change of tone from a massive mainstream investor. Why do some see Bitcoin as digital gold?
So the analogy of digital gold, Bitcoin being digital gold, is a very popular one. I personally like it very much. And it comes from the fact that Bitcoin supply is limited. There's going to only ever be a maximum of 21 million Bitcoin. So one day in the faraway future, when the limit of Bitcoin is reached, there's no more Bitcoin that's going to be produced. So Bitcoin's inflation rate, if you look at it, it's actually it's an inflation rate that actually goes down every 4 years. So it's a bit technical, but there's a process known as the halving, whereby the creation of new Bitcoin slows down every 4 years. So Bitcoin, in that sense, is a very interesting asset, which we like to call it a disinflationary asset, meaning that its inflation goes down over time. And if you look at the inflation rate of Bitcoin today versus the inflation rate of gold, as in physical gold, the inflation rate is actually pretty similar. So I think where Mr. Paul Tudor Jones is coming from is he's looking at the fact that Bitcoin supply is limited, and if the demand continues to go up, he expects the price to rise.
So at this point in time, not all 21 million Bitcoin are out in circulation yet?
Nope. So right now we are, I think, somewhere just below 19 million Bitcoin. So we've gone up 2 million plus to go.
Right. And gold is, as it is, a time-tested hedge against the US dollar. So why the need for Bitcoin then?
I mean, gold's an interesting thing. I wouldn't say these are disadvantages of gold, because gold obviously derives its values from some of them. But gold, you can't literally move gold so easily. It's heavy, you know, there are security risks. Whereas Bitcoin, being a digital technology, you can basically move Bitcoin anywhere around the world you want, as long as you have an internet connection, within 10 minutes. So whether that's 100 ringgit worth of Bitcoin or say 200 million worth of Bitcoin, that transfer can be completed really quickly versus something like gold, which might take you a very, very difficult trouble to actually move it long distances.
Right. So essentially, the allure with these two kind of assets like gold or Bitcoin is the fact that you just can't create more out of thin air. And that's one of the concerns some are seeing out of governments like the US government printing out more dollars. Now, whatever said and done, though, Aaron, the US dollar is backed by the US economy, government, military, and its standing as the world's reserve currency. So beyond the principles of demand and supply, what backing does Bitcoin have?
So there's multiple angles which people have actually tried to answer this question, because it is a very relevant question, right? You can see gold, you can touch it with your hand, but Bitcoin, what value does Bitcoin have? Because it's literally something that exists on the internet. So I think I like to point, people who have this question towards the digital world, where things that you can't necessarily touch or feel, but these things have value. And examples of these things might be a digital movie or a song. You know, technically, it doesn't exist in a physical form, but we know it has value because it brings a lot of value to people. So what we're seeing with Bitcoin, and this is especially with the younger demographic, you can look at the millennials or the early Gen X, we're starting to see this demographic shift of people really wanting to invest in digital assets. I think people have warmed up to this idea and we're seeing a lot of demand. So I think the question of, you know, US dollar versus Bitcoin is not entirely a fair comparison right now, because US dollar has been around for so long, whereas Bitcoin is so new. But definitely the data shows us that people want digital assets and they want them more.
So Aaron, from that example, I think one of the clear differences I see personally is the fact that things like digital music or digital video, the value comes from the utility or the enjoyment of that asset. You experience it in one way or another. How does it apply to something like Bitcoin?
right? So the if we're being a little bit more, I guess, philosophical, the power of Bitcoin or decentralized cryptocurrencies comes from the fact that before this, there was almost no way for large groups of people to agree on value transfer. So, you know, you can do value transfer because you have a middle person, and that middle person is usually, for example, a big bank or, for example, a government. Whereas cryptocurrency or Bitcoin actually allows you to do value transfer without actually having to go through so many intermediaries or third parties. In other words, it allows you to do this peer-to-peer transaction, which I guess as a concept, it's sometimes very new, it's something that we're not comfortable with. But if you think about it, this concept of removing the third party, of being able to do things directly, is actually very powerful.
And I think part of this utility on a macro level is the concept of Bitcoin as a asset, as a currency, right, on a much wider level. Now, acknowledging the full fact that it isn't legal tender in Malaysia, the volatility is something that particularly concerns me, because if Bitcoin is to become a future currency, having this volatility doesn't bode too well for it.
Personally, I don't exactly love the term cryptocurrency because it tends to trip people up, right? When you say currency, you expect to be able to use it for, buying a cup of coffee or something, which is not what we're seeing right now. I actually love the term that the SC uses, which is digital asset. And the fact is, you know, people don't really use Bitcoin or crypto right now for transactions, in especially small transactions. Right now, it's really in the stage where people are just investing in it. And I think some research has shown that only maybe 1 or 2% of the world population has access to crypto. So it's not going to be used right now as a currency. But who knows, maybe in 5 to 10 years, when, say, 10 to 20% of the population has access to crypto, it might be more common then.
So one of my personal worries, I think, with this is that with that volatility, there comes a lot of risk, right? So right now we're calling it it's a digital asset as per the SC's use of the terminology there. But with that volatility, it becomes a very speculative asset in that sense. Now, isn't that risky for the regular investor who's maybe taking a look at Bitcoin?
So I think you pointed it out rightly, Roshan, that, you know, the risk profile of Bitcoin is not something that, let's be honest, it's not like we're investing in bonds or something, right? Bitcoin is traditionally higher volatility and higher risk. So I think investors do need to understand that we're not asking people to dump their entire life savings into Bitcoin. But I think everyone should perhaps take a look at this new technology, allocate a percentage of their investment portfolio that they're comfortable to take a higher risk with. And I think this is a reasonable strategy. Given someone like Paul Tudor Jones that you mentioned earlier, he, as much as he believes in Bitcoin, he invested only 1 or 2% of his net worth. So I think everyone can perhaps take a look at their own portfolios and definitely don't invest more than they can afford to risk right now.
Right, on that note, Aaron, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Roshan. It's always a pleasure.
Now, as we just mentioned, remember that Bitcoin has its risk. As with all possible investments, you have to do your own homework into the asset, keeping in mind your risk profile and financial goals. You've been listening to Ringgit & Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Roshan Kunnison for BFM 89.9.
Ringgit & Sense on BFM 89.9, the business station.